Hello and welcome to Megacity Book Club. I'm Eamon Clark and this is the podcast all about 2000 AD collected editions, where every episode I'm joined by a different guest who chooses the book we discuss. And in this time, it's another friend that I've made through the wonderful world of 2000 AD, the chap who takes the paper copies of the prog off my hands, David Grice. David, welcome.
Hi, Eamon. How are you?
I'm very well. And yourself?
Yep, not too bad, up in the sunny north.
That's it. Is it still sunny up there?
It's not been so sunny today. It's been a bit breezy, but yesterday was really nice. I can recommend a visit sometime if ever you get up to the cursed earth kind of area of the country, we'll call it.
Yes, if I can journey across the cursed radiated wilderlands, then I will get to you at some point.
Very good.
Okay, so you know the format by now. I'm going to ask you about your 2000 AD origin story, David. How did you get into the prog? What was your first memories of it?
Well, right back in the day when I'm definitely a prog oneer, I'm afraid.
Another prog oneer.
Yeah, another prog oneer.
You're all going for putting me to shame.
Oh, I meant to ask yours after this. So, yes, definitely a prog oneer. I remember the advert being on the TV and everything and thinking, oh, to go down to Todd's, the newsagents, and check one of those out. And I remember bringing it home with the space spinner attached to the front cover and thinking, why would you stick this on with sellotape, really, and have to try and cut that off the front without ripping the entire thing to bits, which I think it did take a hole out of the cause it was really cheap pulp paper copy as it was then. And then, promptly losing the space spinner at some point, as everyone seems to have done. That seems to be the thing, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm afraid so. Was it the neighbour's garage roof?
Do you know, I can't even remember where it went. Probably went into a bramble patch up the back garden, I would have thought, if anything. That's where my Batman cape and the skull and crossbones plastic PVC kite ended up. Well, that seemed to eat all those kind of things. It was a cursed sight of bramble bush, that must have been.
Oh, right, yes.
It's probably still there.
Stealing all these child's toys.
Oh, yes. Yeah, those were the days. But prog oneer, and I didn't stay with it too many years, to be honest with you. So it was a dropout kind of thing after that. But good couple of 3 years, the initial storylines of Dread, and I remember the Dan Dare stories and all that. It was brilliant. It was a fantastic. I don't know, the paper and everything was so cheap, but it was just such a fantastic comic. It was. Well, following on the lines from the big Marvel, if you remember the Mighty World of Marvel, I think it was about 72.
I remember those. Yes, I used to get those in the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a golden period for me reading those comics as well. So it was that and the occasional trip to the seaside and pick up a copy of a DC Superman or Batman to read on the bus on the way home. Those were the golden periods of comics for me. And 2008 comes along, starts doing it in a nice British style, as it were, after Action Comics had folded and all that kind of stuff had gone. So yeah, definitely early days, and the colour spread and everything. That was a fantastic little bit in the middle of the Dan Dare stories and Dredd's story taking off from episode two, well, prog two, we'll call it, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
8 pence of Earth money well spent every week.
And then you had a bit of a gap, and when did you get back to it?
Well, this is bringing us back around to what we're reviewing today. That would come back in, which would have been around the, because we haven't really mentioned what we're discussing yet, have we?
No.
The Zenith stories would be about where I came back in again. I had some friends, because a friend in particular was a lot cooler than me, saying we got to discussing Thunderbirds and all the classics in our childhood in 2000 AD. And he says, you can still buy it. And I thought, it was one of those stupid kind of penny dropping moments thinking, yeah, you can actually still buy it. Why didn't I just go and get it again? So I actually got back into 2000 AD again around this kind of period, which is what we're looking at. It's about, what was the year when it came in?
This is 1987. So tell us, it's Zenith Phase 1 we're going to be discussing then, is that right?
Zenith Phase 1 seemed to be the best place to start. It's not the best of the phases, as Grant Morrison refers to it, but it's definitely the start, and it's a good place to start with Zenith because it was a really good story, in my opinion, anyway. So, yes.
So splendid. Zenith Phase 1, Progs 535 to 559 from 1987.
1987, yeah, that's the time. So about 10 years after the
launch.
Yeah, 10 years in, I'm back in the 2000 AD fold, as it were.
Brought back into the fold by Grant Morrison, Steve Yoel, and Mark King on letters.
Yeah, Mark King.
And Morrison and Yoel will reign throughout the whole thing, I think, apart from a couple of episodes drawn by somebody else in later
in a
phases.
Something like a sci-fi special, I think there was one, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes, that sounds right, doesn't it? There's a few sorts of extras and so on.
Yeah, it was a bit of a sidestep, wasn't it? And then ending with that zenith.com or whatever it was called, which I think everyone had, well, Grant Morrison particularly, got a bit fed up with it by then, I think. It's hard to say. It had peaked, obviously, and it could. There's nothing to say it couldn't be brought back. You never know, do you? Never say never with these things.
Well, yes, he's another global superstar now, though, isn't he, Grant Morrison?
He's definitely a titan straddling the globe, isn't he?
Yes, a big name. And, of course, I mean, here's one of his first things. I mean, he'd had Odds and Sods published by 2000 AD before Zenith. And as I say, it was 1987. And then I think Animal Man for DC was the following year, 1988. And then he did Arkham Asylum in 1989, and I think that was the one that just rocketed him into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
Probably one of the best-selling graphic novels of all time, really, isn't it?
It's easy to see why. Who wouldn't be enticed by going over to America, really? I mean, obviously, the Gibbons and Moore partnership doing The Watchmen and all this kind of thing, it had already happened there, hadn't it? So why not? It's where you would go, isn't it, really? I suppose on the career path, you'd head for America.
Yes. Well, as it seemed in those days, that 2000 AD was the nursery slopes for the British invasion to America, wasn't it?
It certainly did, yeah. The British are coming. And in fair play, I think definitely did, did a lot of good to the American comic scene, to be honest with you. I'm not saying it was in bad shape. It was obviously going to keep going. It had a bit of a glut in the 80s as well, didn't it, with all the, there was a bit of a mass produce of everything in comics. There was a big takeoff, wasn't there?
But yes, yeah. And then we got the 90s and all things went all sort of wrong. But
yes, in a big style. But which brings us back to, I don't know, but definitely our little British invasion going over, it really gave them a fresh injection of talent that did them quite a lot of good, didn't it, I think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Alan, apart from us losing all the best artists like Bolland and Alan Davis and everything like that, but there you go.
Yes, 2000 AD losing all those greats, but
all
as you say.
All the Batman comics and everything. The Killing Joke, for instance, that was a classic, wasn't it? Yeah, the Killing Joke was
yes, great. And so, must be, again, about the same sort of time, I should think, isn't it? Late 80s?
Yeah, I've got a first copy of that somewhere, so I'll have to dig that out from the loft at some point if I can find it, but yeah. And they've made some sort of animated video of that, haven't they, I think, now, The Killing Joke? I don't know what the quality of that's like.
Controversial, I believe, is the quality.
Is it?
Yes,
right.
I've heard. I haven't seen it. It has, as you say, just recently been released, the Killing Joke animated. There is some controversy in there, I think, particularly in a relationship between Batman and Batgirl that's, of course, not from the comic itself.
No, it was quite... bit more adult than that, wasn't it, really, what happened to a Batgirl in that? But I'll stay clear of that then, stay with my graphic novel memories.
Okay.
Definitely.
So tell us a bit more about Zenith. Why particularly this choice? And tell us a little bit about what the story of Zenith is.
Well, why Zenith? Well, Kim, like I said, in my origin story, back in the 70s, Prog 1, leaving it, as you do, because you get too old for comics, and thankfully I'm younger than that now, as the line goes, back in 87, and we've got Zenith. And it was like, you know, I was saying earlier, you've got the colour cover and back page, which is usually advert for Tree Boss Sweets or something like that, and then you've got your colour centre spread. Zenith was straight in with black and white, and it was... The first one I really think that really appreciated Yowell's art was really appreciative of the black and white medium. It's fantastic in black and white. If anything, it falls a bit flat where there's a bit of colour introduced. As you know, in the phase one book, you see what there's a couple of colour pages, isn't there, in it? The covers.
Yes.
The covers are okay-ish, but it just does not seem to work in colour somehow. In black and white, it's fantastic. It's just, you know, and to see a strip that was in the black and white pages and actually, you know, really, really doing not just justice to everything, but really, I don't know, it was superlative in black and white. It's just brilliant. The colour aspect of it, it doesn't seem to work somehow for me. When I see it in colour, it's a bit, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. Towards the end of phase one, they sort of engineered Zenith to appear at the end of the prog so that they could take advantage of the last page colour, didn't they?
Yeah, and you see the big...
The big bads.
The big bads in colour. And, very green.
Lots of green, yes, yeah.
But not really such as an impact. You've got a few, you know, you've got... you've got an atom bomb in black and white, for goodness sake, going off. And you think, how could anyone do that? But it's fantastic. And it's, it just works, isn't it? Not that there's anything fantastic about an atom bomb going off. You want to be well away from those things. It gets pretty hot. But yes. You know what I mean? It's, it just really worked in stark black and white. Everything just sort of, you know, it's just there. It's just fantastic. So steering clear, it was the one thing I remember growing up with was, well, you know, you hope Dredd gets the centre pages and a bit of colour this week, or Dandare's, you know, the big colour spreads and that, fantastic. But this, I was really thinking, I'm enjoying this in black and white, and it was so good. Excellent. Can't defy the quality of Yowell's artwork in that right from the get-go. Brilliant.
It is actually lovely stuff, isn't it, as you say. You know, possibly some of the best stuff he's ever done for the prog, you know. Certainly the most detailed black and white stuff that we've seen from him, I think. It's beautiful.
Yes. I mean, but he had a bit of a background in sort of jewellery design or something like that. Was it something like that he did? Silversmith design or something? I did read a bit of a bio of him, and then he got into the artwork, and definitely his best place to be.
I seem to remember him talking about that on the Thrillcast with Michael Molcher when they were talking about the Apex edition of Zenith being released.
Yeah.
Yes, his background in commercial art and then moving into 2000 AD. Yeah, their loss, our gain.
Definitely, yes. So that was the main reason, thinking, right, we'll come back into 2000 AD, and there was this new character. There was other things in the comic at the time, obviously, because it's an anthology. Got Brendan McCarthy and everybody was really experimenting with Dredd and everything, but Zenith was just a new one. And I think it's right to say that this was the first possible superhero character in 2000 AD, which is a strange one as well, isn't it, to me?
Yes, for a comic that doesn't do superheroes, and when they do superheroes, we get Zenith, as you say, and it's an interesting one, isn't it? Their own 2000 AD's own quirky take on the superhero genre.
Yeah, it's got elements of, I mean, you'll get people saying it's got elements of Moore and Gibbons's Watchmen about it, hasn't it? But when they've gone off to the over to the colonies there across the pond, we've got our British take on it, which is that's the other aspect, isn't it? Really, they've taken it to America and done a fantastic version of Watchmen, but now we've got our own. You know, the UK version of that, really, as it were. It's much, I don't know what I had to put into words. It's still a big story, but on a smaller scale. And it makes the story bigger somehow, doesn't it? Does that make any sense? I hope that makes sense.
No, I think it does. I mean, as 2000 AD is fond of saying, you know, we've got our British superhero, and he's a pop star who's more interested in his latest single and sleeping with Page Three girls than he is in fighting crime.
Yes, the definite anti-hero superhero as well. So it's not the likable type for a kickoff, is it? Robert McDowell, Zenith.
Zenith, yes.
Yes, more very self-centered, very 80s driven, very Thatcherite Britain, wasn't it, really? Make as much as you can. And, you know, that was the ethos, wasn't it? I'm all right. I've got a big pile and that's it really, isn't it? It's yeah, definitely. Why should I fight for you? This kind of aspect that he's got, hasn't he?
Absolutely, yes. And he's got a jacket with huge shoulder pads because, as you say, it was the 80s.
It was the 80s, yes. And back to Brendan McCarthy. I didn't know until I got to the back of the book that McCarthy did a lot of the design to start with, didn't he?
Yes, I believe. Was it supposed to be him originally? Is that right?
I think it was originally, you know, in his remit to do it. He designed the characters, I believe, and Yoel took it on from there. But I think Grant Morrison was saying something that McCarthy wouldn't have worked with it. He said he would have found it a bit too pompous or something along those lines. And it would have been. I love Brendan McCarthy's artwork. I've actually got I've got a page of Brendan McCarthy, the one page of original artwork I've got. I've got one 2000 AD page. It's the it's from the Atlantis story with the Brexit judges, because he really it's the end page of which is about halfway through the story, and it ends with next coming Eric Jekyll, your time is up. So it's got the Brexit judge on. It was a piece of artwork when I was in London at the time. I couldn't resist, so I actually got that from all those years ago.
Lovely.
Back in the 80s. So yeah, I did really love Brendan McCarthy's artwork. He really had a lot of fun with the dread stuff. You could tell the helmets changed shapes. The Brexit judges, I don't know if he was the first instigator of the Brexit judges, but I thought they were fantastic with the lion, you know, helmet tops and all this kind of thing. I thought he had a great time with it. So it's one of my favourite artists, but it would have been a completely different beast altogether, I think, doing Zenith somehow. Even the same story, different artists, it would have been a completely different flavour. And I think Yoel, definitely the best artist to go with in this case, but both fantastic artists in their own right, definitely.
Yes, and I mean, as you say, it works perfectly. It looks superb in black and white. It's sort of edgy and atmospheric stuff. And, you know, there's true horror to come towards the end of phase one and in the later phases, I know.
Yeah, the later phases, obviously, we've gone for the hardest one to discuss by going with phase one, but you need to start at the beginning, I feel. So, you know, whether we ever get back to doing 2, 3, 4, etc., you know, that would be great. But phase one's the best place to start, I suppose, isn't it?
And starts with, as you say, the horror of the an atomic bomb being dropped, but this time the Allies are dropping it on Berlin because there's a conflict going on between two superheroes in World War II.
Yes, it's got that nicely sidestepping alternate Earth bit of Watchmen-esque kind of thing, where you get Nixon going for another term. You've now got the atom bomb being dropped in Berlin because you've got Maximan and Masterman duking it out, and our poor chap coming the worse off.
Yes.
Almost getting killed in the process at the hands of the villain there, the Nazi possessed villain, but salvation in the form of everyone gets killed in the vicinity by the nuclear bomb. Yes, not very good, but there you go, a bit of a change, but a nice little twist.
Yeah, an interesting prologue. And then, of course, we're straight into the 80s and Zenith and his pop career and his biorhythms, which he's sort of linked to.
Yeah, the other interesting thing being, of course, in the own Zenith story, he doesn't appear till the second part either, does he? He's not in the first one at all. So it's, it's had some groundbreaking things of doing that. Yes, Zenith literally crashing in through his manager's, I think it was the skylight roof or something like that, wasn't it? Or was it his own apartment?
Yes, returning drunk.
That was it. Coming back drunk, and the manager's there, isn't he? And crashing through when he's been out with a page 3 model, and we get back up to date with the not really interested in anything other than himself, was he really? But yes, the Nazi aspect, that was quite interesting, wasn't it, really, I suppose?
Yes, it was. Yes, I mean, there's that book that he sort of sees at the end of the first episode where, you know, like, what could possibly go wrong? And there's a book with a swastika on the front. So, yeah, if you're going to pick villains, well, you know, Britain's favourite villains, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah, I suppose so, really. But at least they were possessed ones, weren't they? So
in this case, yes, they're much worse, if that's possible.
Definitely. So, yeah, and the story progresses from there. It's definitely a bit of a flawed masterpiece as well, isn't it? It's a bit like bringing another aspect. It's a bit like Blade Runner in that the more times you read through it, the little bits you find, there's been bits since I've been rereading it thinking this Nazi-possessed super creature wanting to make a breeding stock out of him, and Ruby Fox saying, one of the other characters from the original 60s group, Ruby Fox Voltage, saying we were sterile. That was a side effect from our superpowers. But then you think, well, how did we have Zenith then?
And yes. So, I mean, this is the British 60s supergroup Cloud Nine.
Cloud Nine, yes.
Who was supposed to work for the establishment, but instead became almost anti-establishment heroes. They dropped out and they became heroes of the counterculture, I guess.
Yes, we are jumping. It's my fault. We are jumping about in the storyline here, but without wanting to give too much of the storyline away for anyone who's not picked up on it, I suppose. The backstory comes through in little filtery bits, doesn't it? There's a whole group there called Cloud Nine. Was it White Heat, Dr. Beat, and all these other characters and the looks and everybody, and who were made as a British kind of superhero group, weren't they? And then decided, no, we aren't going to do this, actually get rid of the uniforms and become one of the, like I say, counterculture scene, weren't they, really? The one that looks suspiciously like Jim Morrison. And the Mandala character is definitely
John
Lennon type, isn't he? Yeah. He's there with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and George Harrison and John Lennon famously in one scene. So, yeah, it's all counterculture stuff, isn't it, really, there? And yeah, the little background and the little aside saying, but you know, they want to breed some super stock so these alternate universe gods can possess the bodies, the stronger bodies, and make some breeding stock from Zenith is the ultimate goal towards the end, I think, without giving too much of the story away. But then, like they say, Ruby Fox is saying we were sterile. That was a side effect of our superpowers. But how did two of them make Zenith? And it's just a bit.
Yes, where did Zenith come from? And as you say, Ruby Fox throughout this story sort of manages to keep him. She drags him along basically with the promise that she will tell him about his parents. And I don't think it's giving too much away to say that he doesn't find that out in the first phase, does he?
No, it doesn't.
They get somewhat distracted by other things.
Yeah, lots happened. There's a bit of smoke and mirrors involved, isn't there? They're keeping the more little truths you find out, the more little things come in to say, that's not actually true at all, is it? Like, we all lost our superpowers. Then all of a sudden, when they sort of need them, the original group, they do get them back again, don't they? We've got Shadwell Reese, the Red Dragon, who still has his pyrokinetic powers. Pyrokinetic is the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, that's the word, yeah.
He's still got his powers, although he's sort of sublimated them in drink a bit, hasn't he? Because
yes, he's dissolved them in alcohol to a certain extent.
To a certain extent. And then there's a little side, obviously all Cloud Nine, apart from Ruby and Shadwell, suspiciously went missing. They've all got little things that happened to them. Bits of them are told in the story that the one fell into a mirror, I think, which is a fantastic,
yes,
fantastic way of going.
Fell into a mirror, Lux disintegrated.
Yeah, that's fantastic, isn't it? But then you already know when you read it for the second time, you think, you know, if you just stuck with phase one and read it for a second time, you think, oh, how much of this is going to be true? Because they couldn't breed, and yet we've got the son of two of them. They haven't got superpowers, but then they suspiciously come back when they actually need them in moments of desperation and dire need. And so how dead is this Cloud Nine group? Without giving too much away, what actually has happened to Cloud Nine and the rest of the group, which is that's left for another phase, obviously. But little intrigues, little bits of this. You cannot trust any of the story, can you, really, in certain respects?
No, I mean, you know, Grant Morrison has a reputation for being a tricksy writer, and here he was, I think, right from the start, he was As you say, things aren't quite what they seem in phase one. There's twists and turns along the way, and the truth about Cloud Nine sort of, I suppose we'll get it in bits and pieces in the rest of the phases.
Yeah, that's how it sort of comes to light. It's obviously, I think it's phase three where it really, that's a fantastic one. But anyway, we'd have to get to that to another day. But yeah, sticking with phase one, you're always on that little walking along. We're getting shown what we need to be shown. And same with Zenith, I suppose. There's not a lot of backstory apart from, you know, they say, we'll discuss, you know, I'll tell you about your mother and father later on. It's not really, he's just there, isn't he? I'm supposing he's about 20s there, isn't he?
Yeah.
And, who brought him up? How did, you know, how did he get to be where he is? You know, just a superhuman kind of character in modern Britain come about still. Obviously, his parents were superhuman, but he's got to have been raised by someone. I'm assuming raising a superhuman is going to be quite difficult.
Yeah, it could be quite tricky, yes.
Especially in the teenage years when you've got quite a bratsy style kid as well. You would think this is going to be trouble, wouldn't you? So, yeah.
Yes, because he's not a calm, level-headed or modest individual, is he?
Not at the best of times. No, it's still a likable character by all means.
But he's a lovable rogue, isn't he?
Yes, just one of those, isn't he? He means well, but he's naive, isn't he? Really?
Yes, a young, successful, trendy rock star, Jack the Lad. Yeah.
So I suppose the what could we say? Using reverse psychology, the lack of control has kept the superhero brat under control because they've just let him fritter his powers away, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. Yes.
Mindless 80s kind of trivia and the elusivity of fame.
Yeah. Yes, we can see him, as you say, in his 20s, but Zenith, the teen years, must have been. Well, who knows? You never know.
Who knows?
Yeah.
each little bit raises more questions than answers, doesn't it, I suppose? And the answers that are there, you've got to question those. So, yeah, it works. Makes you very paranoid, I suppose, and it works on so many levels.
Yeah. What do you think about the whole subject of superheroes and superheroes in 2000 AD? Do you have much time for them now, or...?
Do you know, that's been the thing. I've always had time for superheroes. I remember, like I say, going back to the early years of reading comics, it was always the Superman and the Batman comics. It didn't seem like it was needed in 2000 AD, and yet one pops up, and, you know, it's only recently I found out it was the first one. It seems quite strange, doesn't it, really? It doesn't really need a superhero character in British comics, do we, as such? But this is very... very anti-superhero, isn't it? He's really grounded in, like you say, he's got his biorhythm. Some days he can't fly. And I don't know, I suppose he's just going about with everyday life, isn't he? I think Grant Morrison was saying he didn't want to do one of these teen angst kind of superheroes, like you've got your Peter Parkers and everybody who's a bit sort of haunted and a bit do the right thing, kind of. He wanted to have this different persona where he was, you know, just a normal kind of bloke, if I'm right in saying that.
Yes, and certainly, I mean, in the 80s, British superheroes, they were a very interesting sort of beast, really. I mean, we'd had Marvel Man or Miracle Man in Warrior, V for Vendetta. I quite like Alan Moore and Alan Davis's Captain Britain, their interpretation.
Captain Britain. Oh, yes, that's another one. I remember getting the first issue of that with one of those rubber band put over your luggage masks and all this kind of
absolutely
stuff.
Absolutely lovely, yes. and then Zenith, you know, 2000 AD's version of the British superhero Zenith, who's, as we say, he's not interested in fighting crime. He has to be dragged along with the promise of information about his origins, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah, superheroes. We do them in Britain, but I don't know. It's very much a British take on things, isn't it? It's how, you know, you can see how the American superheroes are big and American, and ours are just sort of British and getting along with things, aren't they?
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, I do actually enjoy the British take on the superhero. And I think when 2000 AD came to do it, you know, what a brilliant concept and how brilliantly delivered by Morrison and Yeo.
Yeah, the little flashback to the war period with Maximan there talking to, I think he's a nurse, wasn't it, there saying he's had a bad dream about something happening. And obviously that was his denouement, as it were, there. It's all, yeah, he's a do the right thing kind of attitude. And you see, they die.
Yes, I know. Yeah, that happens in one of the epilogues, doesn't it? We get that sort of moment of Maximan and his, presumably his nurse girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And send this bit of tank shrapnel home, you know.
Yes, that's right. Who was it? It was your little brother's collection, that was it.
Yeah. So, yeah, obviously a big brother kind of, you know, but he's out there. He's saying the ordinary private soldiers don't like him much because they think he's just there for the reason, you know, but, you know, he's up there and he is fighting and he is getting, well, obviously, he gets killed. Simple as that, isn't it? So, yeah, it's a very British take on the superhero. People do get killed. Normally, you get killed in the superhero comic, the Americans will find a way of bringing him back after a few issues, won't they? They'll change for a few issues, be a dark Superman or something like that, and then he'll be back again. You think, yeah.
Old Maximan has been dead and stayed dead.
Yeah, I'll probably get my own memorial, he says, not just, doesn't he? Yeah. Don't want you ended up in a name on a memorial piece. The nurse is saying to him, oh, don't worry, I'm Maximan. I'll probably get my own. But he doesn't mean it, I don't mean to say it in a nasty way. He doesn't mean it in an American way. I'll probably get my own memorial. He was meaning it sort of cynically, wasn't he? He was self-effacing there, yes. Saying, I'll probably get my own memorial, and then off he goes to his doom, doesn't he?
So. Yes, to his poor doom in Berlin against the evil of Masterman, and then the bomb dropped on them.
Yeah, and again, cynically, we find out that was plotted. They wanted to see if he could actually survive it.
Yes.
They knew they were sent. They sent him there. He was saying, oh, just sending me and a few of the troops off to Berlin. And, it was all just to test out the atom bomb and see if our modified human could survive it, which was really, that's just not cricket at all, is it really?
No, it's terrible, isn't it? Yes,
terrible.
Awful.
Yeah, but then again, you've got, that's a brilliant aspect of the writing. It's like a lot of the time towards the end of the war, working on the heavy water projects, a lot of the Americans are going off to bring back the German scientists, weren't they, and not destroy the entire atom bomb concept. They wanted to build it for themselves,
yes.
Which, again, ultimately leads to the Apollo missions. You've got all the...
Project Paperclip, I believe.
Yes. So, yeah, you can see in retrospect how the story works by saying, yeah, I can see very well if this had been a possibility, they would test an atom bomb out on our own person. And you think, yeah, that's just the kind of daft thing we would do, isn't it? So sent him merrily off to his own death. So ultimately, who was the villain there?
Yeah, that's right, yes. The English High Command, perhaps, or the Allied forces.
Yeah, we've got Payne working on his, again, towards the end, working on more of the same, isn't he? So.
We introduced to this character Dr. Payne. Is it Dr. Michael Payne and his his program N-Genetics?
P-E-Y-N-E, but sounding the same as Payne, isn't it?
Yes.
Dr. Payne, we'll see you now. So.
Absolutely, yeah. Good name for a doctor, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you see this one, I would steer clear, wouldn't you?
He's not necessarily up to any good, as is indicated in the second epilogue at the end of phase one.
So, I mean, that's the other thing. You obviously know from the little glimpses you've been given of the backstory and the other aspects in the epilogues, you know that there's more to come. So that is the beauty of it. You get the feeling that this is, although it is phase one, it could have been just a self-contained, that's it, that's a lot, folks. But you do get the feeling that this is just a flavour of what's to come. And it does build on brilliantly from there, doesn't it, really?
Yes, as we'll hopefully go on and find out in the other phases. We've mentioned the big bad because obviously we've given hints along the way. There is a sort of, we see them in that colour image. It's The many angled ones.
The many angled ones, yes.
Yes. Or one example of the many angled ones that we might be seeing in phase one. That they have to go up against. That's quite, I mean, we mentioned the colour image, and as you say, a couple of pages later, they appear in black and white, and it's much more impressive, the stark black and white image that Zenith and Mandala appear, go up against, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's only the two colour, actually in the strip itself, I think there's only the two colour pages, ignoring a few of the... obviously, it made the cover a few times. There's only two colour pages, isn't it? The black and white really does outshine the colour, doesn't it? I don't know how he's managed it, but it's brilliant. The many angled ones. Yeah, this is one of the many angled ones who's obviously possessing Masterman Mark II, and he's still jollily wearing his. Those German trousers called that flare out the top there, and he's still got
his
the
jodhpurs.
The jodhpur type trousers, yeah. He's still wearing his jack boots and everything, and he's still got the buzz cut, you know, Aryan super race kind of blonde hairstyle and everything. So he's still keeping to the stereotype, but the maniacally possessed demon host. He's definitely a strange character. But like you say, it works so much better in black and white, doesn't it? Yeah, it's hard to say. They're after world dominance, but then they need a super kind of body to live in to contain them.
Which is why they want Zenith, because as you say, this slightly odd plot of trying to breed a new race of super-powered demons using existing superhumans as breeding stock. Yeah,
doesn't explain at all where Masterman came from, or Masterman Mark II.
No.
So you're thinking...
How did that happen in the first place?
Yeah, they can make... They've just... I know there's like about 40 years between the two of them, but they seem to have made another one. It was exactly the same. They've cloned one and made another one. Wouldn't have taken much to say maybe it was because he's a clone, he was genetically... unstable or something like that and decaying all the time, but it's not mentioned, is it? Then we've got one and we've got another one.
Yes.
But we need breeding stock. It's a bit perplexing at times, but that's where you as the reader come in and fill in your own bits, isn't it?
As
Ridley Scott would say with his Blade Runner flaws, I'd like to leave gaps for you to fill in. You can decide how that ends. Does he go off into a brighter sunset? Does he go into a dark oblivion? That kind of thing, you know. As we'll find out when the Blade Runner 2 comes out next year or something like that, after about 30 plus years.
Oh, please, no.
That's going off on us another tangent there, aren't we? But yes, that's happening, isn't it?
Yes, I know it is. Oh, please, no.
Yes.
But there you go. All right. So, yes.
Yeah, you don't have to watch. You can stick with the original memories.
I think I'll stick with the original, yes.
Shall we go back through the... a bit more of the phase one in detail as best we can without spoiling it for everybody.
Yes, fill us in on some of the gaps that we've left, and in fact some of the gaps that Grant Morrison leaves. As you say, we're introduced to Zenith and Ruby Fox, who used to be Voltage and turns out still is. And then it's to track down one more survive. Well, in fact, a couple more surviving members of Cloud Nine.
Yes, we've got Shadwell turning up, haven't we, really? Oh, we've got Mandala, of course.
Yes, who's given up his hippie ways and turned into Michael Heseltine.
He's the real... Yeah, no, I'm glad you said Michael Heseltine, because the Tarzan, I always assumed it was Michael Heseltine and Tarzan, because of the slicked back blonde hair, although you can't tell because obviously it's just black and white, but the slicked back blonde hair, the tie and everything, I always thought Michael Heseltine. I thought it was a perfect parody.
Yep.
And we've got the 60s... you know, LSD type Timothy Leary dropout guru, and now was in this, you know, suited, sharp cut, suave Michael Heseltine type.
Conservative MP and member of the cabinet.
MP, yes. Oh dear me! But you go into the little character sketches at the beginning, and they've said Peter St. John, Terence Stamp, thinning hair, fine features, and they've put an MP. In parentheses, Kilroy Silk. No, I never saw it. I know exactly about a few of us will know well who Kilroy Silk is.
I remember him, yes.
Anyone else listening worldwide or not of that era will have to just Google him, and there'll be some video footage of him out there as well. Not that you'd need to do, but yes, Michael Heseltine, I would have said it was him, the MP, more than anything. And
who obviously denies that he's still got his superpowers and actually doesn't really want to have anything to do with Ruby and Zenith. So they have to head to Wales to find Shadwell, don't they?
Shadwell Rhys, the Red Dragon. And rather in the notes, again, in the character sketches at the back, cross between Dylan Thomas and Harry Secombe. And lovely. He's a fantastic character, though, isn't he? He's the lovable Shadwell Rhys. He's just there. He's obviously a bit too much on the sauce there. It looks to be his own pub, from what we're assuming. It's his own pub that he runs, and just
yes, yeah, like professional footballers from the 60s, their superheroes retire and run pubs in Wales. There's Shadwell in the Welsh valleys, and he's drinking his own profits by the looks of it.
He looks to be, well enjoying it, doesn't he? You can see from the state of him that he's really enjoying retirement, as short-lived as it will be in this case, or has been. But I don't know. This is, I was supposed to bring back in a Watchmen kind of character. He's the comedian type of the story, isn't he? Because there's a bit of an aside later on when he says, when I learnt about the plan... I won't attempt to do it in a Welsh voice, but when I learnt about the plan, that's when I knew I couldn't be part of the group anymore. So he dropped out of the Cloud Nine, didn't he? This thing of the plan. What is the plan?
Ah, right. Yeah. Yes, a little bit of foreshadowing there.
Which alludes, again, you know, a bit like the Watchmen with the comedian getting killed, if anyone's seen obviously everyone, the world and his wife, seen the Watchmen.
Yeah.
Same thing there. He wouldn't go along with the plan, would he? The plan.
No.
The sinister plan. So he dropped out. Does Ruby know about the plan? Does Peter St. John know about the plan? This is the thing. Obviously, we find out later as well that Peter St. John's got his own agenda as well, but that's another aside, isn't it? But yes, Shadwell Rhys, let's stick with Shadwell for a while. I find he's a lovable character, isn't he, really?
He's the most charming character in Phase One. It's wonderful, and they do this sort of, there's a sort of training montage, isn't there? They have to persuade him that he still has his powers, and then get him to use them and get him to practice, because he's obviously quite a bit out of practice.
From introduction in part six, where he's got his own little picture there. Don't be, sit down, don't be a stranger, and he's obviously well drunk there. Chapter 7, Fear of Flying, which I'm going to have a quick look at here now. And Zenith, the bit against character, sobers him up, doesn't he? And instills this fighting spirit in him, the one that he hasn't got, and says, this is what I came here for. And gets him back to being the Red Dragon, doesn't he, pretty much. But it's really against Zenith's character, is that I find that entire chapter, would you say?
Yes, I mean... Presumably, Zenith just wants to get this done so he can get back to London and Page Three Girls, I presume.
That's what you would say was his own little get-out. I want him to do this, but
anybody's going to fight a Nazi Superman, it's not going to be me, it's going to be the Welsh Dragon.
It's going to be the Welsh Dragon.
Yeah.
And I think he's got a lot of time for the Welsh Dragon. He doesn't like Peter St. John much, but he's got a lot of time for the Red Dragon, hasn't he? I call him the Welsh Dragon there, sorry about that. But yes, the Red Dragon there, he's got a lot of time for him, hasn't he?
And he does, actually. I mean, it is, as I say, Shadwell is the most charming character in Phase One. And almost sort of against his better instincts, Zenith actually is rather taken with him as well and becomes rather friendly with him.
Maybe like an uncle paternal type figure for him there that he's never had, you would think.
Well, maybe you're right, because as we say, where were his parents? Who brought him up? We don't know. Perhaps he's lacking that paternal or uncle figure, because they do rather hit it off. But sadly, it doesn't last for very long, I'm afraid.
It doesn't last very long at all, does it?
No.
Which is one of those one of those oh moments, isn't it? Yes, we got the, like you say, the whole montage scene of him. Right, we'll bring him back off the sauce, as it were, get him fighting fit, gets back into uniform. He's got that rather strange helmet on, hasn't it, really? He's got to say, it works, but it's, you think, I don't know why you would design that. But it does work. It harkens back to, like you say, older style British comics, isn't it? Which brings us back into phase three, where we won't mention, but a few other characters come back in. They've obviously done a knowing wink to earlier kind of comic superheroes in the British vein, haven't they? There?
Yes, it looks great, but you just think, how can you see out of that?
Yes.
How can you see where you're going?
You're saying it looks great, and I'm not too sure. It works in the comics. It's one of those things that if you ever made a film of it, you'd think we're definitely not going without
helmet. We're not going without helmet, no.
No way. And again, in the character sketches, it says somewhere back there, and I noticed they haven't done it, in the Red Dragon character sketches towards the end of the book, if you get the phase one book, there ought to be a Welsh dragon on here, but I've not drawn it. I couldn't find one anywhere, so I'll stick one on. But he still doesn't have it, does he? So no. he's booted and suited towards the end of chapter 8 there with the helmet on and everything, but he still hasn't got the dragon on his chest. So unfortunately that didn't happen.
No, so. He's slimmed down a bit as well, I think, with the training.
Dramatically.
The booze.
The booze has just dropped away quickly, which he will do, of course, if you do that kind of thing. That's a good reason for getting off the booze, come back out fighting a bit. But like you say, his retirement, unfortunately, rather short-lived without... what can we say? What can we say without spoiling it for everybody?
Well, let's say that Shadwell doesn't make it to phase two, unfortunately.
And for someone whose main power is in the fire department... Very ironic as well, isn't
it? Yes, it is. It is terrible.
Oh, dear. You think, would you not have some sort of...
flame resistance?
Yes. that's what I was looking for. You think, it borders on being a bit sort of, that shouldn't have worked, really, should it? But there you go. It's shocking as it is. His denouement is very shocking because he just really got into a really likable character, and there you go.
Yes, as you say, yes, it does seem a terrible shame. And then we're into the big battle with back in London with the second Masterman.
Second Masterman, Masterman 2. Poor Ruby's got there first by going by train while the other two were flying there.
And you yes.
think, I'm not quite sure how that's working. And without dirtying the podcast, I think everything's on strike down south at the moment as well, isn't it?
It is, yes.
It's definitely an 80s thing then, isn't it? So public transport must have been working a lot better then.
I was going to say, she gets there quicker by train than they do by superhero flying, but yes, you're quite right. Yeah.
How that works, I don't know.
Maybe they followed the wrong motorway.
Maybe that could be, yeah. Yes. They were just up for the flight. So she's there and out at Paddington Station and straight into a battle with a super enhanced... many-angled one.
Yes, Masterman 2, or as you say, the many-angled one who is possessing him or using him as its earthly agent.
And to be honest, she stands her ground really well, doesn't she, to say this is, although we are assuming this body's been frozen for 40 years and she's from a child of the 60s, she's done really well. She's doing a double-decker bus about, isn't she, and zapping the old villain a few times with some lightning bolts. So, yeah. And then we've got Peter St. John on the sidelines watching, thinking there's a couple of superheroes fighting down there and the policeman trying to get him off the scene, isn't there?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Can you come with me, sir? We've got to get you to the bunker or something like that, isn't it?
Something like that. What was he saying? Yes, sir. I also remember you lost your superpowers. There are worse things to lose, officer, believe me. I'm not quite sure what he's alluding to there.
But... No, I'm not quite sure what that means either, but
Yes, he's a bit concerned. I think he's probably still got a bit of a torch for Ruby somewhere there. But then we get our first up to the battle with, like you say, poor Shadwell. So Zenith steps in finally, doesn't he? And yes moment, really, for anyone reading it there. Thank goodness someone's really now stepped up to the plate again, aren't they? So, and delivering a swift kick to the superpowered.
Is that what he's doing? So, yeah, Zenith arrives and kicks him in the jodhpurs.
Super villain's reproductive area, we'll say, shall we? Yes.
Another reason why they might be sterile.
Yeah, definitely that one. And it's quite a good scene, isn't it? Actually, there's quite a good fight scene in that there. So it's definitely going for the having a bit of fun with a bit of breaking out of the frame pictures there, isn't he? On a few pages there.
Yes, it is actually. Yes, they break the frame, and we do get a very superhero panel. We get the name Zenith, and this is for Shadwell Rees.
Yeah, and why not, indeed? So he's just found one figure and lost him again, hasn't he? And,
yes.
But then it takes a bit of a downturn again, and we've got Zenith going, Eddie, get me out of this city. So, yeah, we're back to form again, aren't we? After a bit of a, right, that was easy enough, and of course it wasn't, was it, really?
No, this superhero business is harder than Zenith first thought, actually.
Yeah, once you're up against once a superhero meets a supervillain, they don't actually play fair, do they, and go down straight away. But it leads to another ending and another ending kind of thing, doesn't it, really? How many doors close, another one opens, doesn't it?
So, it does. You know, Grant Morrison, I think, does that quite well. You know, we think the villain's been defeated, but of course it's not. It's actually, they've just defeated its sort of earthly vessel. And then we get, as we've talked about several times, this big green back page colour spread of the many angled ones.
Which doesn't, like you say, there's nothing wrong with the artwork. It's just the colour doesn't do anything for it, does it, really?
No, it's strange.
When you see Zenith in colour, you see the trousers are yellow and black, and the Zenith lightning bolt, it looks to be in blue in this, but that's probably just an effect, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just an effect from the colouring and of the shine out from the, because it's back to yellow again in the other colour page. So, yeah, it's probably just an after effect from the many angle ones. But, like, it is the black and white that shines out better than the colour. I'm just going back to the appearance of Peter St. John as the 80s version of Mandala, although still suited. If you look at that one-page spread where he's appearing super-powered up again, do you know the one I mean?
I'm looking at it now. Yes, it's beautiful.
It is. It's like, what could I compare it to? It's like the British version of Psychedelia again, isn't it? It's
yes.
That. It's the Revolver 66 Beatles Revolver colour, black and white cover against all the acid colours of the other 60s Psychedelia, isn't it? It's
yes.
Like, we can do this in black and white. We can do it in a British way. And can we do it so well? And yeah, that's why I find a parallel with that. It's like the Revolver cover. It's black and white, but it's one of the best albums of all time. And you think, yeah, it just works. It's all black and white. You would expect that to be colour, wouldn't you? And this one-page spread of Peter St. John as a phoenix-risen mandala, it's just amazing in black and white how he could make that work. You could see it in black and white being so colourful somehow, can't you? It's just, but in colour, it wouldn't work. And that does not make any sense for anyone listening who's not seen the picture, I'm assuming, really. You've got to see it for yourself, haven't you?
Do you, at the back of your book, do you have some of the quality comic covers?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
So do you happen to know, they were presumably American reprints in American sort of comic size.
The quality comics, yeah.
Was it coloured for the American releases? Were the internal pages, or did they keep it black and white?
Do you know what? I think they coloured it.
You know, they probably would, because Americans don't handle black and white comics very well
They wouldn't pay for it at all, would they? I think they colourised it. I'm pretty sure they did, but I'll have to. We'd have to look into that, because that's something I should have done. But I think they colourised it.
Okay.
You get a page of quality comics covers that's got four on, haven't you? And the artwork's quite passable on those, but the colours are dreadful. And then you get two full pages of some, well, I'm not saying it's, I don't really want to say what I think. They're just, I don't know. He's got green trousers and it just doesn't work at all, does it? They spelled Britain wrong, for one thing. Maximan, Britain's own superhero. It's meant to be a picture of him bursting in on Adolf Hitler. It doesn't even look like Hitler at all, does it? It's just, dear me. Yeah, so even when it gets to the States, the colorization doesn't work at all on the covers. I'm assuming, I probably even have those somewhere. I did get some of those quality comics at one point, all the way back when, thinking I'll get these, and I might even have those somewhere. So I will have to look.
A question that we'll answer for you, listener, when we come back for phase two.
Phase two, we'll have found out the definitive answer, because I think they only published about two phases of those in Quality Comics before it folded anyway, didn't they? I think they caught up with the run by phase three.
Right.
I think they only did the first two phases. Quality Comics went, and I don't think they got the phase three onwards. Could be wrong, somewhere along those lines. But yes, black and white for me, I'm afraid, still, definitely.
So if you've got your copy to hand, listener, do turn to the end of episode 11 or part 11 and look at the last page of Mandala appearing in the sky. As you say, a single page splash page that is just lovely.
Yeah, the other thing we haven't mentioned is the symmetry of the story as well. I know we've got the symmetry of comic style in Watchmen as well, haven't we? You've got your Rorschach character, obviously, but then there's a symmetry throughout the story. Similar in Zenith, haven't we? With the same panel with the Masterman Mark II about to bludgeon Zenith, although not kill him this time, but bludgeon him into subconsciousness, follows on from him defeating Maximan. Well, the Mark One version, isn't it? It's virtually the same strip, isn't it?
It is, yes, that's right, as you say.
The beginning, the first chapter, you end up with the bomb being dropped, and this time you end up with Mandala resurfacing, don't you? So it's pretty much exactly the same. Yeah, you've got symmetry there, haven't you? You've got.
You have. I'm just looking at it now. You've got two almost identical panels, and then you've got a big splash page. But instead of a mushroom cloud, we have the arrival of Mandala.
And we've got darkness is coming, and then interrupted by salvation. Although one was salvation and damnation, this one's salvation proper, isn't it? I suppose. So, yeah, there's a certain symmetry. And with William Blake's Tiger, isn't there? All that, so the fearful symmetry, I suppose, that's something else that Morrison's alluded to throughout the story, isn't it? That there is a symmetry in the story, that there's bits that have echoed through. We've got the same villain, we've got the same superheroes, we've got the same as it really ended kind of thing.
Which bit is called Tigers? Is it the epilogue that's called Tigers, I think?
I think when they originally reprinted it as a Titan publication, I think they called the whole phase one, I think they just called it Tigers, didn't they?
I think that's right, yes. That's probably where I'm getting that from.
Yeah, I think phase one might have just been called phase one in retrospect of all the other phases coming in. I think the original one might have just been referred to as Tigers. They haven't really, they've not really put any of that artwork in, have they, from the original reprints, the Titan version of it. I think it was called Tigers. So, yes, interludes as Whitlock and Payne. Where is the Tigers bit of it? I'm flicking through.
Well, I've got the all-in-one hardback edition, and I don't have the quality covers in the back. I've got the Titan covers in the back, and you're quite right. Book one, Zenith, Morrison and Yoel, Tigers, it's called.
Yeah.
So there you go, right on the front cover.
Yeah.
And as you say, there is a William Blake sort of theme running through the first phase, and we see glimpses of the sort of tiger and something about the fearful symmetry in the background, I think, on the monuments, don't we?
Yeah, it's the reference on his memorial stone, isn't it, really? Yeah. Tigers thing. And it's also Payne's interlude two, right near the back of the phase one as well. I reread Blake's poem, The Tiger, that evocation of the power and terror of raw creation, and I saw my purpose clearly articulated. I would rescue the future from humanity. I would create tigers. So this is Payne's, his tigers are the super race, as it were. So he's very much a British kind of Dr. Mengele type he's turning out to be in the end. Who are the villains going to be in the end? Which has left it open again, hasn't it, really?
It has, yes. So we've sort of wrapped up the story without giving too many spoilers for the ending of phase one.
I'd like to think we've been suitably evasive of the entire story, so someone will have their appetite whetted by that, I'm hoping so, and not think it's just a rambling of a doddery old northern type.
And a southern type as well. And Zenith gets a sort of happy ending. He thinks it's all nicely wrapped up. he gets a drink, he gets a party with his agent and presumably another one of his models from one of his pop videos or something like that.
Presumably, but there's still, like you say, after that, his manager's saying, what about a follow-up, eh? And cheers, and the startled look on his face.
Yes.
By follow-up. And then we go back to Berlin, present-day Berlin, which is now obviously back up and running again, and we've got the ending, the sinister, shadowy endings of one of the characters who was constructive in bringing back the Maximum Mark II character, who's getting her reward, I'm supposing is the word we're looking for, without giving that away, aren't we? So there's obviously, the whole thing is now saying it's the end for now, isn't it, really? It's not the end.
Absolutely, it's not the end, yes. And as you say, we get quite a few clues that there is more to come for poor Zenith. There are various sort of people and beings with plans for him.
It's definitely the place to start. If you've not read Zenith before, phase one is definitely the place to start. And you can go away thinking, well, that was fantastic, but it's still not the best one. But it's still good enough. It's brilliant. The artwork is fantastic. The story, it holds up. There's some holes in there. But then again, the gaps are there for you to fill in, aren't they? And there's some lies in there as well, obviously. Some definite red herrings. And you can see some of the heroes aren't going to be as clear-cut as they're meant to be, can't you? You can tell there's some subterfuge going on there, can't you, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's the best part I can say about it, isn't it? It's not really over. And yeah, you could say looking back, it's not the best one of the Zenith stories, but it was a start. And for a start like that, that's just wow. It just knocked me over. I thought it was brilliant. So what can I say?
It's terrific. Yes, absolutely. Do you have a favourite sort of moment or character from phase one, if you were able to pick one out?
The favourite character would have to be poor old Shadwell.
Yes,
I'm a fan. In memoriam, poor Shadwell.
Yes.
But also, I just love the little touches of the Cloud9 group. You know, we've been introduced to some survivors of the group, not at their best, but what were the Cloud9? Who were the Cloud9? And we find out a bit later on, obviously, don't we? But, you know, the backstory like that is... it's just to build on, isn't it, really? I suppose. So, yeah, Shadwell's definitely the favourite. Poor Shadwell.
Yes, poor Shadwell. He is the best character in Phase 1, although I do also have a sort of soft spot for poor old Maximan, the rather outgunned British superhero from World War II.
Yes, the daring do-or-die guy, wasn't he?
Really? Yes.
Yeah, one of the true Brits, I suppose, yes. Poor chap. I'm being sent unnecessarily to his own doom.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
Again, that also brings us to the fact that who is the real villains in this? They knew he was going there, so there you go.
And if we were to play fantasy artwork page, you know, you could have one page or one cover from phase one. Would you be able to pick one that you would like to own?
Well, like you were saying earlier, I think with the Apex edition coming out, I think Mr. Yowell himself has kept all the artwork for these, hasn't he?
He has, yes.
To be honest, it's hard to pick one. I really do like that panel of Mandala, resurfacing Phoenix. Like, you've got all the characters there on one big panel page, haven't you? So I suppose that one. But there's so many little panels that it's the little details, the little panels that give it away as well. There's little... There was one in particular, one little picture of Zenith, and it's just before he actually, we'll say, defeats. It's just over, a couple of pages over from that one-page panel where he defeats, should we say, he gives a good battering to the Maximum character there.
Yeah.
It's just one little sliver panel of Zenith where you'll have to find it for yourselves, readers, if you get to this. There's a bit where the evil villain's going too late, looking rather maniacal, and going too late again. There's one little sliver side panel of Zenith in there, and I think that is actually fantastic. That little, yeah, time's up, he's saying. But it looks brilliant. There's that little sliver there. I don't know, it's one of the...
It's a lovely little panel, actually, isn't it? Yes,
yeah, it's
saying.
Just there, isn't it? Just sort of stuck in right by the spine of the book, and it's fantastic. Is that, yeah, time's up, and then wunch. But we won't say what happens there. We'll let someone else find that out for themselves. But yes, the one page I would dearly love would be the Mandala picture there, the big full page spread, but just the little details that he's filled in, that he's just filled it, hasn't he, really, with superlative artwork. Because, yeah, story, first class, there's details that you can fill in yourself, red herrings, the artwork, it's a perfect symbiosis, isn't it, really? It's brilliant. McCarthy is one of my favourite artists, brilliant designs. It would have been a completely beast, a completely different beast if he'd done the comics. So I'm glad they went with this mix, actually.
Yes, it is. It works perfectly. I'm going to give a quick shout out to Steve Dillon for his cover for 535, which was the first prog for the sort of prologue, which is the Masterman Maximan cover.
You know, I remember Steve Dillon's covers. Fantastic.
I love a Steve Dillon cover, and that one is a stunner.
He's also got the 540 mandala one, but that's heavily influenced by some of the Owl artwork already, I would think.
Yes, it is.
And you've got a McCarthy / Yowl cover on at 536 that'll get a reprint in the Phase One book as well. So, yeah, I like the Steve Dillon's covers were so clear, weren't they, really?
Absolutely. So, dear listener, if you know who owns the original art to those Steve Dillon covers, get them to put a picture up on one of the Facebook 2000 AD art groups. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, fantastic.
And you mentioned the Apex edition, which of course is this huge edition of Steve Yowl's original artwork, most of which he's still got for Phase One. Have you had a chance to have a look at it in a bookshop?
No, I don't think there's anywhere around here that will be a copy of that, actually. No, I wouldn't. I imagined it. It'll all be shrink-wrapped and neatly packaged up as well, but... From the artwork I've got with the Brendan McCarthy, I know some of the speech bubbles start decaying where the adhesive is, isn't it? I know mine's gone pretty see-through on the speech bubble that Dredd's saying. So the killings happened here in Atlantis, kind of thing. And you can see McCarthy's artwork coming through the speech bubbles underneath. There's little details that come through as certain bits of it start fading. So. Does he own all of it still? I assumed he'd kept all of it. I thought they'd republished it from the Apex of Phase One from all the original artwork. And so it's that slightly bigger size as well, isn't it?
It is, yes. I did get a chance to leaf through it on the 2000 AD stand at a convention, I think in London this year. And it is lovely. I mean, it is just, you know, a wonderful thing. It is huge. It's a massive, great piece of art. The whole thing, but yeah, it's lovely.
In a nice little slipcase and everything, isn't it? I was watching one on eBay. I think it's currently going for £90 plus £7 postage and packing, and that's the signed booklet edition as well. I think, it's still £97, and I'm thinking I cannot, one day.
Okay, so you've been reading from the Phase One book, and I'm reading from the collected edition that they brought out.
Because of copyright issues, was it something that was been in copyright limbo for years, hadn't it, really?
Yes, and I believe they hope they managed to solve the problems and bring out the special edition, and that paved the way for the release of the phases in individual volumes.
I'm not too sure how happy all the individuals concerned were about that. I think Rebellion were quite happy getting it out there, and it's good for everybody wanting to buy a copy out there, but I think Mr. Morrison wasn't too best pleased, was he, really?
Well, I don't know. We heard differing versions about what Mr. Morrison thought about it, and of course the Titan editions that we'd mentioned were changing money for silly prices because it was difficult to get hold of. So it is nice that
it's good that it's back out there. You can buy individually and just get it piecemeal, can't you? If you so wish, you can just get the phases separately and get yourself a nice slip cover. I think the slip cover's still available to hold all the phases in from the 2000 site still, isn't it? The 2000 AD website.
I believe that may be right. And of course...
£15 for a slipcase to put them all in once you get them all, or aspire to getting them all in, can't you? So, yes.
Lovely. And you can get Zenith Phase 1 as a hardback. It's £20 from the 2000 AD online shop. Or you can get it digitally for $9.99. Or you can buy it through the apps for Apple, Android and Windows 10 devices, all from 2000 AD.
Very good.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is certainly available. You can get hold of it. And I guess about wraps it up. Anything you'd like to say in summing up Zenith Phase 1, David?
Just if you've not seen it, go out there and believe everything you've heard about it. It is that good. And it gets better through phases 2 or 3 onwards, isn't it? Especially 3, but that's another one. You've got to work towards it. Don't jump straight to phase 3. Build yourself up. That's all I'll say.
Build up from the prologue and
build up.
Phase
get that
one.
Back. Get that backstory fractured and, you know, undetailed as it may be, but build yourself up. Start with phase 1. Be suitably impressed with phase 1. Imagine how impressed you're going to be by phase 3.
Excellent.
That's the best I can say, isn't it, really?
So thank you very much for listening. Do get in touch with me if you'd like to come on and be like David and review a 2000 AD book with me. We are on social media, so please like the Facebook page, follow on Twitter, or email me mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, and you can find all these links at megacitybookclub.com. As always, thanks to Brian from the British Invaders Science Fiction Podcast for hosting Mega City Book Club. The title music is Circuit Breaker by RoboDub from the freemusicarchive.org. And finally, thanks very much for doing it, David. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
A few technical difficulties to get to this, but it was all worked out in the end.
It's been my pleasure. It really has.
And are you going to come back next year and do phase 2?
Shall we do phase 2 next year? That would be good, wouldn't it? If people are wanting more, we'll do phase 2. That would be great. Yes.
Let's set that up and make that happen for next year.
Fantastic.
So until next time on Mega City Book Club, when we'll be passing judgment on another 2000 AD book, it's time to say goodbye. It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.